welcome to Joshua Judges Ruth. Thank you. Thank you. Joshua Judges Ruth is the podcast about the Old Testament books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. I'm Ken Lanning. Yes, thank you for joining me for the inaugural Joshua Judges Ruth podcast. I'll do my best not to refer to it as JJR, though that's how I have it written in my notes. What I intend to do with the Joshua Judges Ruth podcast is go through the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth from the Old Testament, more or less verse by verse, hitting on history and theology to what extent I can as I go. Disclaimer, I am neither a historian nor a theologian. So why would a podcast covering the Old Testament not start at the beginning, Genesis? Good question. Well, in my mind, we're going to be referencing the first five books of the Bible a lot anyways, and also, since so many of those stories from Genesis and Exodus are so familiar, I didn't really feel the need to go all the way back to Genesis. Besides, when I first conceived the idea of this podcast, I was just going to cover the book of Judges, but Joshua bleeds into Judges. Ruth takes the place during the time of the Judges, and since calling the podcast Joshua Judges Ruth was so appealing to me, I decided to move back and start at Joshua. And yes, I'm aware that Julia Roberts' ex-husband Lyle Lovett has an album called Joshua Judges Ruth, but I have not heard that. Now, I could have started with the fifth book of the Bible, Deuteronomy. Some biblical scholars will refer to the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings as the Deuteronomistic history of Israel. But Deuteronomy is somewhat a retelling of events described in Exodus through Leviticus, and much of that book does not lend itself to a compelling narrative being a list of laws. I'm not saying it's not fascinating, but its narrative value is lacking in many chapters, and I prefer this podcast to be more narrative in nature. Besides, who would listen to a podcast called Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings? I will admit, however, because I looked ahead, the first three episodes contain a lot of background and history, and not a lot of narrative. Sorry about that, but it couldn't be avoided. So let's start at Joshua. Except we can't start at Joshua. The book of Joshua tells the story of the Israelites' conquest of Canaan, or ancient Palestine, and begins just as Israel is about to cross the Jordan into Canaan. I'll use Canaan and Palestine somewhat interchangeably, just as I'll use Hebrews and Israelites interchangeably. So before we get to the Jordan River, we need to talk about why the Israelites were invading Canaan and where they came from. According to the Bible, the ancient Hebrews moved into Egypt from their home in Canaan because of a famine. That's right, the Israelites were from Canaan in the first place. Canaan is the land promised to the Israelite patriarch Abraham. The promise was specific and has ramifications for us even today. There was a severe famine in Canaan, and Egypt was experiencing the same famine, but because they had planned ahead and stored food during some prosperous years, they had enough grain to sell. The ancient Hebrews at this point consist of Jacob and his 12 sons and their families. Jacob was renamed Israel, thus the name we call them today. One of Jacob's sons was named Joseph, and because of his impertinence and the fact that he was somewhat of a spoiled brat, his brothers sold him to Ishmaelite traders some years before. The Ishmaelites then sold him to an Egyptian official named Potiphar. Through a series of events, Joseph rose to the rank of what we might call prime minister today. It was because of his ability to interpret dreams that he saw the seven prosperous years to be followed by the seven lean years. He then advised the Pharaoh to store grain during the good years, which is how Egypt came to have grain to sell during the famine. We know all this only from the biblical source, the book of Genesis. Neither the name Jacob nor the name Joseph appears in any Egyptian records, nor does the name of the Egyptian official Potiphar. The Pharaoh that Joseph served is not named in the Bible, which further frustrates our efforts to place this encounter. However, there are some documented examples from Egyptian history that help set precedents. As for people moving from Canaan to Egypt, there's a report from an Egyptian border official in the Anastasi VI papyrus, dating from the late 13th century, that states the Shasud tribal people from Edom were allowed to enter eastern Egypt. The report sounds positively humanitarian in that the people were allowed in, quote, to keep them alive and to keep their cattle alive, end quote. The full quote goes like this, and here's the usual history podcast disclaimer. I don't speak any of these ancient languages, so when I pronounce words wrong, just go with it. Here's the quote. We have finished letting the Bedouin tribes of Edom pass the fortress of Merneptah, which is in Jakku, to the pools of Per-Ultum, which are in Jakku, to keep them alive and to keep their cattle alive, end quote. I wanted to read the quote to point out that Jakku is the Egyptian name for the land called Goshen in the Bible, which is where the Hebrews settled once they reached Egypt, according to Genesis. Per-Ultum is the biblical Pithom, which is a city where the book of Exodus tells us the Hebrews worked as slaves. The Hebrews entered Egypt as herders, but Exodus tells us that a pharaoh came to power who did not know Joseph and became worried that the Hebrews could become a threat, so he enslaved them and put them to work making bricks. How could a Semite rise to the position of prime minister in Egypt? Well, we don't know, except for what Genesis tells us, but we know a group called the Hyksos ruled Egypt from about 1675 to 1552 BC. The Hyksos were Asiatics, probably from Canaan. In light of this, and especially during their reign, it's not inconceivable that a fellow Semite might rise to such a high position. Their reign didn't last forever, and they were eventually driven back to Asia by the Egyptians. The Egyptian records indicate slaves were tasked with making bricks, just as Exodus indicates. The Egyptian records talk about quotas and how certain quotas were not being met. Exodus points out that the Hebrews were beaten when they did not meet their quotas. A 15th century BC tomb painting shows Semitic slaves making mud bricks, and the text complains of not enough straw, which is exactly the complaint made by the Hebrews in Exodus. An important point here is the biblical text does not tell us that the Hebrews were forced to cut stones for the building projects, which is what they used to build with in Canaan. If Exodus said that the Hebrews were cutting stones, it could mean that the oral traditions were based on life in Palestine, not in Egypt. Similarly, there is an Egyptian text that says that workers had gone out to make offerings to their God, a request that the Hebrews made to Pharaoh in Exodus. And just one more point as we're trying to figure out if the ancient Hebrews spent time in Egypt. There's an Egyptian papyrus that lists the names of 40 female slaves with Semitic names. One of these slaves is named Shipra, which is the name of one of the Hebrew midwives named in Exodus chapter 1. I'm not saying at all this is the same Shipra. It most likely is not, but I believe it does help establish the plausibility of the biblical narrative, whatever other objections historians and archaeologists may have. So was there a sojourn in Egypt by the ancient Israelites? I think the answer has to be yes, and we can discuss the form it took, but it seems clear the ancient Hebrews must have spent time as slaves in Egypt. Why would a group of people indicate that their origins were as slaves and faithfully transmit that generation after generation if it did not have some basis in fact? We have plenty of origin stories, but this is the only one we're aware of that articulates such an inglorious beginning. So we say, yes, the people who came to be known as Israelites did spend time in Egypt as slaves, but again, we say that not based on archaeological evidence tied directly to a group of people called the Israelites or Hebrews. We're getting closer to Joshua and the Jordan River, but there's still more to cover. At some point, a man named Moses is born in Egypt to a Hebrew mother. Moses is an Egyptian name. It was given to him by the daughter of the Pharaoh. The name Moses derives from the Egyptian verb meaning to give birth and is a common element in other Egyptian names like Tutmosis, Amenmoses, Tahmoses, and Ramses, which means born of Ra, and others. He was adopted by the Pharaoh's daughter because his mother, a Hebrew woman named Jochebed, refused to kill him per Pharaoh's order. Instead, she hid him for 3 months, but when she could hide him no longer, she put him in a basket and sent him afloat in the Nile. That's where Pharaoh's daughter found him. She ended up hiring Jochebed to wean Moses, but then he was sent to Pharaoh's court where he was raised. Moses recognized he was a Hebrew because he later witnessed an Egyptian beating a fellow Hebrew, and in defending the Hebrew, he killed the Egyptian. When word got out about what he'd done, he fled to the desert and began working for a man named Jethro, who was not a hillbilly, rather he was the priest of Midian. One day, while tending Jethro's flocks, God called to Moses from a bush that was burning, yet was not being consumed. God told Moses that he had seen the affliction of his people, the Hebrews, and was sending Moses to deliver them from their taskmasters. I'm not going to cover the Exodus here in detail. You've seen those movies. Well, maybe not the one with Christian Bale, but the one with Charlton Heston you've seen. So let's cut to the Israelites on the east side of the Jordan after escaping Egypt and spending 40 years in the desert making their way towards Canaan. And here is why we have an invasion of Canaan by the Israelites under Joshua's command. The Lord had already promised this land to Abraham and his seed, and now at this point in their history, Israel was on the verge of taking control and possessing Canaan. Again, we have to concede there's no extra-biblical source that even hints at a large-scale exodus of the Hebrew people from Egypt, though numerous attempts have been made to uncover some sort of archaeological proof. The Bible does tell us, in the book of Numbers, appropriately enough, that there were 603,550 men, aged 20 years and older, who were able to go to war that escaped during the Exodus. That's a lot of people, roughly 2 million or so by the time you add in all the women and children. The Bible details their travel over the 40 years spent in the desert, but no archaeological digs have revealed evidence of this large of a population inhabiting any one place, though they did spend 38 years at Kadesh Barnea. There is no archaeological evidence of an exodus, and there aren't any Egyptian records either. Why wouldn't there be? Well, that in itself does not mean there wasn't one. However, other rulers and other pharaohs had tried to expunge certain people and events from their histories. The pharaoh Akhenaten, who died around 1336 BC, tried to institute his brand of monotheism in Egypt and had the names of other gods chiseled off their monuments. Amenhotep II tried to erase the memory of the Egyptian queen Hatshepsut, who died around 1458 BC. Amenhotep had her face and name chiseled off the monuments, walls, and cartouches. The Romans even had a name for this practice, damnatio memoriae, or damnation of memory. Various Romans suffered damnatio memoriae throughout the centuries. I say all that to say perhaps the Egyptians erased the memory of the Israelites and did it effectively. It makes me wonder who all has been lost to history because of this practice. We know about the ones where they weren't successful in totally destroying their memories, but what about the ones where they were? If we're going to study such a momentous event in history like the Israelites' conquest of Canaan, it would be nice to know when it happened. So, when did Joshua and the Israelites arrive at the Jordan? Short answer is it happened 40 years after the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. Well, when did that happen? Good question. I guess there's no way to do this but to dive into it. We don't really know when the Exodus happened, and the Bible is frustratingly limited on specific details. The ancient Hebrews didn't have the decency to use the Gregorian or even the Julian calendar, and they refused to number their years in accordance with the BC and AD dates with which we're familiar. Seriously, though, the Bible doesn't tell us what year the Israelites exited Egypt, and again, the Bible doesn't tell us who the Pharaoh was in Egypt when they left. So when did the Exodus happen? Can we tell? If we use the Bible's own timeline, it goes like this. Scholars agree that King Solomon, the third king of Israel, died in 930 BC, give or take a decade. This is one of the first touch points we have with a known event in history in the history of ancient Israel. King Solomon reigned for, yes, 40 years. In the fourth year of his reign, he began to build the temple in Jerusalem. The fourth year of Solomon's reign would be about 966 BC. 1 Kings 6:1 says that work began on the temple 480 years after Israel came out of the land of Egypt. That puts the Exodus at around 1446 BC. But do historians have a problem with the state? Yes, they do. Why? For one thing, Palestine during this time was essentially Egyptian territory. It was under the control of a strong pharaoh from this time named Thutmose III. If the Hebrews escaped from Egypt to Canaan, they basically would have gone from the fire to the frying pan. It doesn't appear that Egypt's control over Palestine abruptly ended at this time. Their power over the region waned in the 13th century, and we're still in the 15th century. Additionally, the Book of Joshua, which we're trying to get to, does not mention battling the Egyptians for control of the land. So this actually brings us to something we do know about Israel from extra-biblical source, the Merneptah. The Merneptah has the earliest reference to a group of people called Israel outside the Bible. It was inscribed in about 1230 BC during Pharaoh Merneptah's reign. I want to read to you the entire section that deals with Israel. The princes are prostrate, saying, "Mercy! No one raises his head among the nine bows. Desolation is for Tehenu. Hadi is pacified. Plundered is the Canaan with every evil. Carried off is Ashkelon. Seized upon is Gezer. Israel is laid waste. His seed is not. Haru is become a widow for Egypt. All lands together, they are pacified. Everyone who is restless, he has been bound." The encounter listed here between Israel and Egypt is not mentioned in the Bible. So what can we know from this passage from the Merneptah? Essentially, all we can know is there was a group of people in Palestine at this time called Israel. The language on the stele seems to indicate they were tribal in nature rather than an organized city, state, or nation. We'll come across most of those other cities in later episodes. As far as all his accomplishments, well, the Egyptian pharaohs, and indeed many rulers throughout history, are known to exaggerate. Given this inscription, we have to conclude that if there was some kind of exodus, it couldn't have been any later than the 13th century. But what about that passage from 1 Kings? It seems pretty clear the exodus was 480 years before Solomon built the temple. We here have to consider that the biblical writers didn't always use numbers the way we do. The 480 years could be symbolic or schematic. Multiples of 40 play a big part in Genesis and the Exodus story. 480 years is 12 generations of 40 years each, one generation for each of the 12 tribes. Also, if you add up all the years from the building of the temple to the return of the Israelite exiles from Babylon, you get another 480 years. The biblical writers may have intended to put the building of the temple at the center of Israelite history. Another couple of items we might look at in determining the time frame for the Exodus are the people Israel encountered on their way to Canaan and the use of chariots. Moses communicated with the kingdoms of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Archaeologists tell us these kingdoms weren't in existence until the 13th century at the earliest. Also, Pharaoh used quite a lot of horses and chariots to pursue the Israelites. Exodus says he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots. But horses and chariots were rare in the 15th century, but increased in numbers in Egypt in the 13th century. So when did the Israelites escape Egypt and begin their conquest of Canaan? The Bible doesn't necessarily tell us. History and archaeology can't tell us, and in many cases argues against a large-scale exodus. But it can't definitively say it didn't happen either. Who knows what future digs or discoveries will reveal about this time in history? For our sake, let's just say sometime between 440 and 1200 BC. That may be as close as we can get until we dig up new evidence somewhere. That brings us to the banks of the Jordan River. Joshua and the Israelites, after spending 40 years in the desert, are now about to cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan. But that is going to have to wait until next week. I say at least because I had every intention of getting to verse 1 of Joshua this week, but didn't make it. We'll just have to see how far we get next week. Until then, thank you for listening to Joshua Judges Ruth. Be strong and courageous. Have I not commanded you?